Coming up on Fronteras, Mayor Julian Castro may head up the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We look at how White House cabinet positions have affected the careers of other politicians.
Here's the thing, it can work out so well for Castro if he takes his job and everything goes well on his watch. If it doesn't, there's a risk.
How working at the White House for the president can make or break a candidate. And it can be tough being a duck in Texas these days.
The population growth in there has been absolutely staggering, and wildlife is disappearing as a result of it, quite obviously.
In Texas, there's less of a duck dynasty and more of a dilemma, at least for one breed. Fronteras is next, but first, the news. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations along the Southwest. All eyes are on San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro, President Obama's pick to be the next Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Mayor Castro is a rising star in the Democratic Party, and the move could make or break his political career, according to political experts. Here to talk more about that is David Nather, Senior Policy Reporter for Politico. First, let's start with how this post could potentially benefit Castro.
Well, it's got a lot of benefits for him if he has any designs on running on a national ticket someday. I mean, national Democrats are looking at him as, possible running mate for Hillary Clinton. In some ways, that's the dream ticket for them. But, he doesn't really, even though he had he gave the keynote address at the Democratic Convention in 2012, most of them still don't think he has the stature of the national profile just yet to justify that kind of a leap. It's much better if he gets some experience on the national stage. Being the Housing and Urban Development Secretary would certainly give him that. It would also help him make connections, political connections, fundraising connections that go even beyond what he has in Texas. So a lot of people see this as a good stepping stone in many ways.
Right. Beef up the resume. But there's something called the cabinet curse.
Yep.
Not everyone benefits politically from the high profile exposure of working for the president, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's the thing. It can work out so well for Castro if he takes his job and everything goes well on his watch. If it doesn't, there's a risk. And the best example of this right now is Kathleen Sebelius, who is going to be stepping down pretty soon as Health and Human Services Secretary. She was the governor of Kansas. She was extremely popular at the time. She was talked about as possible running mate for Obama. But now, she's not considered a strong statewide candidate anymore. If she had wanted to run for office again, she was actually poll tested against Pat Roberts, who is the incumbent Republican senator right now, and she did really, really badly. This was after the clumsy rollout of the Affordable Care Act. The rollout has gotten a lot better now. It's moved out since then, but everybody remembers that website that just didn't work and the canceled plans and all this sort of stuff. It just seems that her brand has been damaged, and right now she doesn't have the political strength to run for office again if she wanted.
Another element I was thinking about is, as mayor, he really guides the direction of the city. When you work for the president, you have less control.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. There are people who come into the cabinet having been governors before, and they're used to running things themselves. But yeah, that's a very good point. Castro is mayor. He is used to a much greater degree of controlling his own destiny than he would have if he's in the cabinet. Again, sometimes it works out very well. There are people serving the cabinet who have run successfully for office. There's Mike Johanns, who was George W. Bush's agriculture secretary. He was elected to the Senate. Bill Richardson, who was Bill Clinton's energy secretary, got elected governor of New Mexico twice. So it doesn't have to end badly, but it can in a lot of other cases. There were a number of other George W. Bush cabinet officials who were so damaged by various Bush administration policies, the Patriot Act, the Iraq War, that they lost their political strength too. Even if they wanted to run for office again, they couldn't have.
already the vetting process has begun. There's scrutiny about how the city of San Antonio has spent HUD money.
There are any number of things that, you know, Republicans want to dig up on Castro to kind of undermine him before he becomes too big a star. They can come out now and they will get more, you know, they'll get more play because of all the attention on Castro. There may be other things. We just don't know yet. But any of that is going to kind of play out real time. The other thing to keep in mind is anything that goes wrong on his watch will be under even more of a microscope because Republicans know what a potential star he is. And there's going to be a lot of incentive to find anything they can to knock him down a few notches.
Definitely a story we'll be following. David Nather, senior policy reporter for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we should add, the Senate has to confirm all presidential cabinet appointments before they become official. Law enforcement and some private citizens at the center of a recent raid on a West Texas hookah lounge are at an impasse. Did federal drug agents assault a woman and search a home without a proper warrant, or are witness accounts from the scene simply not accurate? Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik looks into the case, one that began as part of a nationwide crackdown from the Drug Enforcement Administration on synthetic drugs.
They're supposed to mimic the effects of pot and other drugs, but they've been linked to overdoses and possibly even some deaths. The shop's owner, Ilana Lipson, was already under indictment for synthetic drug charges from the past couple of years. DEA agents found ammunition at the scene that she's not allowed to have because of those indictments and filed charges. Her sister, Arielle, was at the shop when agents showed up. She's being charged with intentionally assaulting a federal officer. It's a charge that carries up to 20 years in prison, and it's also where the story of what exactly happened that day starts to get murky. A day after the raid, Ariel claimed she was the one who was assaulted. Sol Ross geology student Nicholas Branson is now backing her up.
I was standing there when it happened, and I know what I saw.
He claims he watched the scene unfold. He rents a small apartment that's just a few feet away from the Purple Zone. The way he tells it, Ariel was frustrated, telling the agents to leave, that they had bigger fish to fry, and they were wasting their time on a small business. At some point, she got into a scuffle with an agent, who said she was resisting arrest. Branson says she was pushed to the ground, and as she was trying to get up, her foot grazed the officer.
And he screamed, "You just assaulted a police officer," and then used the butt of his rifle to subdue her and hands on her throat.
At no point did the agents rough her up or put, you know, the butt of a rifle to her neck.
That's Lila Rico, the public affairs specialist with the DEA's El Paso office.
She was kicking the agent, then we have a problem, and that's why she was arrested.
The agency is categorically denying any allegations of abuse, including Branson's claims that he was harassed when agents entered his apartment. Court documents show the DEA only showed up with a warrant for the hookah lounge, not the apartment. But they quickly realized the error and called in a second warrant. Rico confirms that agents did enter the apartment, but didn't immediately search it. And she says they had the right to do that.
For agent security, we are allowed to secure the premises.
The two agree that agents did enter the apartment, and that an officer instructed them to head back outside while they waited for the second warrant. But the story splits again on what happened next.
And I was like, well, if you don't have a warrant, you need to get out of my house. At which point he responded, "I don't need to show you a warrant."
That's a serious allegation, so I called Branson back just to make sure we had it right. Okay, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I can. I just want to clarify what exactly you were told by that agent.
When I asked to see a warrant, his response to me was, "You don't need to see a warrant."
Never was he told that. No agent ever spoke to him that way or cursed at him. That is just untrue.
The case is in some ways a standard he said, she said story. The Lipsons are both free on bond, but the conditions behind Ilana's release are drawing some scrutiny.
And they presented me with a document that
Ilana spoke to us and other media outlets after the raid, claiming the officer did indeed assault her sister. But as part of her bond conditions, she agreed to send a letter to the media and retract those statements.
That being the Big Ben Sentinel and the Alpine Avalanche.
That's the prosecutor laying out the terms at the hearing. She would also have to explicitly declare that it was actually her sister who instigated and assaulted the agent, the very charge Arielle is now faced with.
That her sister instigated and assaulted a federal agent.
Yeah, I think that this order is a violation of the First Amendment.
That's Eugene Volokh. He's a law professor at UCLA. He says prosecutors and defense attorneys can agree on special bond terms. That's nothing new. But those terms can't require that a defendant say something or not say something.
Otherwise, the government would have a great deal of power to essentially force people to give up their First Amendment rights as a condition of being released on bail.
Volokh says prosecutors often agree to more lenient charges in exchange for testimony.
But here, the defendant has not been tried, has not been convicted, and her liberty can't be conditioned on her saying something or her not saying something.
The U.S. District Attorney's Office wouldn't comment on the conditions, other than to say that the document, quote, speaks for itself, and the state district attorney insists there was no coercion involved and that the letter was not edited. But it does raise some questions, mainly since the letter reads almost word for word alongside the specific retractions that were called for in the bond release terms. Whatever the jury decides about the facts of the case, it's created a noticeable tension in a community where law enforcement employs a large portion of the population. And local businessman Tom Cochran's become the focal point.
I lived in Pflugerville actually before we moved out here. We lived down in Terlingo for a year and we came up here.
He snapped pictures the day of the raid and shared them on Facebook. Since then, he's become a sort of crusader for Branson and the Lipsons, spreading the story on the internet as far as he can.
Because these sort of things get swept under the rug so often, because we have a tendency to discount anything people say when they're accused of a crime, because, oh, it's just a criminal.
The local chapter of the National Border Patrol Union voted to boycott his screen printing shop, calling him a purveyor of misinformation and asking others to join them. Cochran says the community's largely been on his side, but he's had at least one ugly encounter.
Some guy in a kind of a Toyota Camry pulls, you know, down his window and flips me the bird. I feel like I'm being tried to portray as some sort of anti-authoritarian type, and it's really not the case.
For those who believe Branson and the Lipson side of the story, the case has become a shining example of an overzealous law enforcement culture in a region where any hour of the day, you'll see just as many Border Patrol, DPS, or sheriff's authorities as tumbleweeds. For others, it's a frustrating example of how facts get distorted and public servants get demonized on a whim. Professor Volokh has faith in the justice system. Despite the unusual and possibly unconstitutional bond condition, he feels that Alana Lipson, at least, can still get a fair trial. He says that's what the jury selection process is designed for. But he also thinks Alana's letter and the prosecution's efforts to sort out what they see as the facts are shaky.
We can't believe a word this person is saying, precisely because it was essentially either you stay in jail or you say these things. Why should we believe that?
Whatever side the public takes on the case, the courts won't decide for a couple of months. Jury selection is set to begin on July 22nd. Reporting in West Texas for Marfa Public Radio, I'm Travis Bubinick.
More Fronteras coming up.
No te dejo, hijo mío, duerme tranquilo. Eres en mi mundo.
A San Antonio treasure is celebrating a major birthday. Singer Rita Vidaurri will mark her 90th birthday. Her story on Fronteras after the break. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. It can be tough to be a duck in Texas these days. Places where ducks once lived are now where people live, in subdivisions. And the drought has changed the landscape as well. State Impact reporter Dave Failing found that scientists are now trying to use satellites and computers to find ducks better places to live.
Ducks are real popular these days.
All right, look, guys.
The number one reality show on cable is about a family in Louisiana that makes duck calls.
We make duck calls. Quack, quack.
Quack, quack.
But next door in Texas, when it comes to ducks, the talk is less about a duck dynasty than it is about a duck dilemma. One prized duck in particular, the mottled duck, a member of the mallard duck family, is causing special concern. In recent years, government wildlife studies of coastal Texas found that the mottled duck population was, quote, rapidly declining. By comparison, populations in Louisiana had been stable. To find out why, I went to Texas A&M's campus in Kingsville near Corpus Christi.
Part of it, I think, is we just don't have extensive coastal marsh like Louisiana does.
Bart Ballard is a wildlife researcher.
Certain places like the Katy Prairie, for instance, that used to be a pretty important rice-growing region, and no longer, you know, it's really taken over with development.
He's talking about areas like this, just southwest of Houston, where I found Rice Field Road. Except now the road borders not rows of rice, but of new houses. In past decades, rice farming here had provided mottled ducks with thousands of acres of irrigated fields to nest in. But now, even in places still used for farming, the drought has severely reduced rice growing. Other factors researchers have looked at include duck hunting and predators like alligators. But Ballard says the consensus among scientists is that changes in habitat are the biggest cause for the mottled duck's decline. which makes the work underway at Texas A&M Kingsville all the more critical. Graduate student Anna Krynick is creating a computer program.
It's supposed to help people pinpoint the areas where it would best benefit model duck populations.
Krynick is using a variety of data to figure where it would be best to fund projects to restore or expand habitats model ducks would like. Previously, state and federal wildlife agencies had to make educated guesses.
So we use satellite images, we use national wetlands inventory data sets, we use cropland data layers, which tell us where on the landscape there are specific types of crops or water or even developed areas like cities and roads.
They hope to have the computer program finished by this fall. It could lead to the creation of more protected habitats for model ducks. One of them is here where I am, a few miles inland from the coast near Freeport, part of the Brazoria National Wildlife Refuge. Along a gravel road, I found a sign that said Model Duck Marsh, and behind it is a vast expanse of a beautiful marsh. And this is where I also found Bob Woods. He shoots ducks with his camera. Woods has taken thousands of photos of wildlife along the Texas Gulf Coast.
I'm 87 years old, and this is what I do for fun.
Getting a model duck in his viewfinder isn't easy.
There's a model duck down there with about five or six chicks.
You saw them?
Oh, I took pictures of them last week. I've never seen an awful lot of them down here.
Woods said the model duck seems to be just one more species impacted as people move to this part of Texas at one of the fastest rates in the nation.
The population growth in there has been absolutely staggering, and wildlife is disappearing as a result of it, quite obviously.
Researcher Bart Ballard said the model duck is important to Texas.
Duck hunting is a pretty important economic thing in Texas. It's a prized duck on the Texas coast, but it's also just part of the ecosystem.
An ecosystem that might not be what it once was for the model duck. For State Impact Texas, I'm Dave Failing.
A San Antonio treasure is celebrating a major birthday. Singer Rita Vidaurri marks her 90th birthday with a performance this weekend at the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center. Rita is a Spanish-language musical icon and was a star during Mexico's golden age of entertainment. But as TPR's Yvette Benavides tells us in her commentary, Rita's life story is also a tale of heartache, strength, and faith.
As I hear the opening strains of Juan Gabriel's Amor Eterno, searing extended notes of violins just behind the repetitive strum of an acoustic guitar, I brace myself for the emotion that's about to be conjured by the singer I'm watching on the stage, Rita Vidaurri. She's stunning in her white blouse and ornately embroidered vest and black slacks. She sings of the sadness that lives in her eyes because she can never see her loved ones again. She sings of how she suffered and been tormented by a merciless grief over a terrible, incomprehensible loss. This is the song that Mexican composer Juan Gabriel wrote for his mother, but Rita Vidaurri modifies the lyrics slightly and reverses the role as a mother sings to her sons. She belts out the song with a vengeful strength in a rich, dark voice that belies her age of 90 years. This is the same strength that's been in evidence as she worked as a caregiver to an elderly couple in their 80s when she was the same age. It's the same strength that she carried with her to work every day at the Methodist Children's Hospital, helping those young patients find some joy in otherwise difficult circumstances. When she was a teen, Rita Vidaurri's father begrudgingly allowed her to compete in a weekly talent contest on the west side of San Antonio. She won something on the order of 18 contests before someone got wise and realized she'd keep on winning if they didn't remove her from the competition and incite her to bigger and better things. Pretty soon she was singing for XCW, the storied flagship radio station in Mexico. From there began her whirlwind tours. She earned the nickname La Calandria, or Songbird. She traveled the world, Cuba, Costa Rica, New York City. She sang with the likes of Olga Guillot, Lidia Mendoza, Nat King Cole, Celia Cruz, and Pedro Vargas. Even Cantinflas himself, the iconic comedic genius, was a sort of godfather to Rita and encouraged her to travel and perform. Hers was a meteoric rise to an ephemeral fame that she surrendered to take care of her children. I first met Rita Vidaurri 10 years ago when she was 80 years old. She was rehearsing at the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center. I was struck first by her beauty, her perfectly coiffed blue-black hair with a shock of gray framing her angular face. Piercing eyes and thick brows, just like Maria Felix, looked deeply at me. We sat down for an interview, and I lost track of time, forgot about all the questions I wanted to ask her. The story she wove was utterly compelling. I got lost in it, all of it. The trips, the Jack's Beer cover ad she did, the movie star she met, the love stories, the heartache. I learned that night that Rita has outlived her three sons, each of whom died tragically. I left the interview that night with a pang of something nameless, a sorrowful sympathy wrapped in a joy at having experienced this life-changing meeting. Juan Gabriel always prefaces his own version of Amor Eterno by saying that it's not so much a song of loss. He says instead that it's a prayer. And if that's so, when Rita Vidaurri sings this song this weekend at her birthday party, when she points up to the sky and talks directly to the sons she misses so much and who have in many ways fortified her ragged faith, God in his heaven will most assuredly hear the prayer from this beautiful songbird.
Mamacita, no te vayas, no me dejes.
No te dejo, hijo mío, duerme tranquilo. Eres en mi mundo. Y lo que más adoro, una risa tuya, disipa el penar. Hijo, hijo de mi vida y supremo tesoro, de tu lado nadie.
That commentary on Rita Vidaurri was from Fronteras' Yvette Benavides. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows online at tpr.org under the Programs tab. This theme music was composed by Chananga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.